The Science of Creativity. When I was a kid, I had an extremely bright and creative group of friends. I still do, really. But back then, sometimes it made me feel a little bit inadequate. I wondered if I were creative. I wondered if I'd be an artist. Well, if I had have heard our guest speaking on today's topic, then I probably would have spent less time worrying about it. This episode will question your perception of what makes someone a creative genius and give you new appreciation for what it takes to become the next Pablo Picasso or Thomas Edison. Get your paint palettes and incandescent electric lamps ready. We're hanging out with the man who has done more to make nerds and tall gingers cool than anyone in DC. Wait, what about Thomas Jefferson?
What is the DNA of business marketing? How do we market ourselves now and in the future? Brand communications is evolving. Are you? Let's explore together. Spiral upwards. This is Spiral Marketing.
Today's guest, Eric Schulze, PhD, is using science to make the world more creatively nerdy. Eric is the co-founder and creative director for Thirst and the Periodic Table, as well as the host for the Smithsonian Magazine's first ever digital studios produced show, Ask Smithsonian. Eric Schulze, PhD, is a molecular biologist, speechwriter, online television show host, entrepreneur, and educator. Eric consults on how science is represented and communicated on the small and large screen. Currently, Dr. Schulze is on detail with the National Science Foundation as the STEM coordinator for the United States government cross-agency priority, goal of producing 1 million STEM graduates and 100,000 STEM educators within 10 years. Dr. Schulze also speaks and writes often about the scientific nature of creativity, as well as how science is branded and communicated. Eric will teach anyone who will listen about why you should never stop learning about this cosmos. Catch Eric nerding out in print, online, TV, and live performances. His work, ideas, nerdery, and gingerness have been featured by the Smithsonian, the Washingtonian, WARN, PBS, National Academies of Science, NASA, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, Reboot America, 1776 DC, the National Science Foundation, and others. Welcome, Eric.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a tongue twister to say, especially the name of my show. I always have to end everything with Ask Smithsonian. Oh, go to smithsonian.com. Smithsonian is a terrible word to use for anything you need to say repeatedly and often. It's like a giant tongue twister in itself.
And technically, it's Smithsonian Enterprises Ask Smithsonian, right?
Correct. Smithsonian Enterprises is the for-profit arm for the Smithsonian. So there's the si.edu, the museums and all the artifacts. And then you have the enterprises, which is what actually makes money.
Something's got to make money over there.
Yeah, they won't tell you about it, but yeah, it's true.
Well, welcome. Today's topic, the science of creativity. Something like that, huh? Let's talk about it. What do you think is the backdrop for the science of creativity that to help prime the audience?
I guess the most important thing that at least gets me is that it's called the science of creativity. Those two words don't go together, at least when you think about it, right? Science and creativity are sort of thought of different realms that don't necessarily overlap. But what's really interesting is if you dive into the scientific literature, you find out that it's a very studied and very predictable. So creativity is a very predictable enterprise. And that science and the arts and humanities actually share a lot in common in that they're very predictable and it's hypothesis driven. You can test it. You can study it. You don't think about that. You think of creativity as a muse, some sort of semi-divine intervention that sort of touches these people in their daily lives. And then they produce, like Picasso produces work or Einstein produces theory of relativity, but not something you can study. That's what fascinates me. So it is. The answer is you can study creativity.
Interesting. When did you start studying creativity?
I started studying it because of one of the organizations that I run called Thirst DC. And basically,
how we met.
That's how we met. It's an organization that's entire purpose is to make sure that gingers meet each other on a regular basis.
And do incredible things together.
A minimum height is 6'3".
yes.
So what we really did is we started Thirst as basically a giant social experiment. There's TED Talks, which I'm sure many people have heard of. There are scientific conferences. There are lectures. There's art galleries. What we wanted to do was we wanted to see if we could make small to medium-sized groups of people do creative stuff. And we wanted to see if we could do it using evidence, like things that you could study and reproduce. I basically wanted to see if I could quantify people doing cool stuff. So I created an organization to try to test those ideas. And I tell people, like, I'm testing on you. Like, you're my experiment. You're my lab rats. So that's where it started. And I realized that I wasn't getting the information I wanted from my own metrics, my own studies within Thirst itself. So I was like, you know what? I wonder if anyone's ever like asked a Nobel laureate how they won a Nobel Prize. That was my question.
Interesting.
How do we know Nobel laureates are Nobel laureates? Like, did they know that growing up that they were going to win a Nobel Prize?
What did you find?
That they did, most likely. Here's the weird thing. People started studying Nobel laureates and they wanted to know what made these exceptional people so incredibly good at what they do. I mean, think about it. Like, Nobel Prizes shape the world we live in. They engender new economic theories, businesses, political theories, and economies. All these things are created under Nobel laureate ideas. They're the best ideas we have. So maybe the person that created them was exceptional in some way, or maybe not. And it turns out people studied that. They asked that question, could you measure it? And the answer is, a lot of these people did know they were going to win a Nobel Prize. And you could predict that they were going to win it before they even knew they were going to win it.
Wow.
How do we know that? Turns out, how much work you put out. So this is a lesson and sort of like a thing that sort of comes out in this research. And creativity is not quality based. It's quantity based. Quality is a totally different thing that we can talk about separately, but the one thing that predicts your success in any creative field that we know across anything, science, art, marketing, public relations, anything, is not necessarily the quality of the work that you put out, because that's actually really hard to measure. It's the quantity, not quality.
That's amazing. So the Nobel laureates might have said something like, well, I wrote enough freaking papers that it was going to happen eventually.
Actually, that's not really far off. You just summarized 50 years of creative research.
Man, they could have called me.
Yeah. You can do their marketing.
Nice. Yeah, the science of marketing, and that's actually closer to how we met, the evolution of marketing. That's a whole nother topic what we really are going to have to explore at some point.
Yeah, the evolution. Well, just evolutionary concepts to begin with. Like, so evolution has no purpose that we know of. It doesn't have an end goal. There's no reason for it to that we know of. But what's really neat is how the environment shapes anything. And we were talking about this off the air, mm-hmm. is the evolution of marketing. What affects evolution? And that really comes down to selection pressures. So how does the environment change the organism to either fit or die? So I guess the question in marketing, which I'm curious about as a scientist, is like, what are the selection pressures? What parts of the environment place the biggest like constraint on marketing as a field and force these ideas to live or die?
Right. Well, you know, it's funny because I think of the evolution of marketing a little bit like a forest, in that they're all vying for sunlight. You know, the sunlight could be dollars, profit, audience, customer value that they're trying to provide and transmute to their audience. Well, they're literally adapting to try and communicate to other communities. So, you know, kind of speaking off the cuff here, but that really is accurate. They're adapting, and they, in order to get market share, they need to adapt their method so that they can stand out amongst the crowd of their competitors.
Interesting. So how would you say, like, for example, the most recent human mutation that we know of is the ability to digest milk, lactose.
Interesting.
Happened about 10,000 years ago in a population in Scandinavia. And it's the most like recent gene that spread itself through the human population is something novel. Like, we're not supposed to drink milk past infancy. That's a terrible idea. Most of the world is lactose intolerant, but we can if you have any sort of European ancestry. And that's hugely shaped the course of human progress, at least in recent human evolution. So I'm curious, like, what maybe in like marketing was that most recent evolutionary trait, that most recent selection pressure, that most recent gene mutation that has pushed marketing into like where it is now, I guess.
Sure. Well, obviously the internet changed marketing quite a bit, you know.
Well, the internet changed creativity too. I mean, it's totally one of the questions that's asked is, do online communities have the same theory of mind? Our collective intelligence is online, or like we're doing real life interaction. You're reading my body language, my emotional state, to try to guess and know what I'm thinking, who I am. You're empathizing, using your emotional intelligence.
Ginger telepathy.
Well,
right?
What people don't realize right now is we have connected using a Vulcan mind meld. And we are actually the same person, separated by several cosmic distances, but at the same place. We're quantumly entangled. Our particles know no distance.
It's really a bonus for me. It's kind of a bummer for you. I'm sorry. My apologies.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, the internet's changed the research into human creativity. It, arguably, we're the most productive we've ever been in terms of producing stuff. Lots of people like to say that maybe we're not producing as much quality stuff. But if we remember what we were talking about earlier, quality doesn't matter. It really doesn't. Being able to judge work, that matters. But as a producer of creative work, all research points to you can't. It doesn't matter. You just produce. In fact, we know that your most cited work correlates exceptionally strongly with your most ignored work. So whenever and that all correlates to your maximum output level. So you can measure how much stuff you're creating. For example, Picasso produced 20,000 pieces in his lifetime as a professional.
Wow.
20,000 as an artist in photography, paintings, drawings, live action pieces. And you can plot what he produced each year, because his life is really well studied, and at his maximal output level is when he gained his most well-known notoriety as an artist. And then that presupposes some other conditions, like he was already an expert when he first started. He was an amazing, accomplished traditional painter before he got into what he decided to do. It became cubism. So
interesting. Wow, you have a treasure trove of knowledge of all kinds of subjects in there. How about, why don't we talk a little bit about how your current work relates to the topic? Because I know you're having to kick out a lot of creative work regularly. How does the science of creativity relate back to that?
The number one thing that helps me, and I think helps anyone if you try, is exposure to what's called distant information. Everyone has an expertise field, everybody. Yours is marketing, mine science. But what's really important is constantly bombarding yourself, actively exposing yourself to information that is not in your realm of expertise. Nothing breeds success like not knowing something.
Challenge yourself to learn something new, and in that pursuit, you grow.
Right. The greatest thinkers that we know, these are what are called system builders, like Einstein, what they did is they didn't just simplify a system with their elegant equations or what have you. They made the world more simple through making it more complex. If that makes any sense. He used a set of equations to simplify a bunch of different fields. He eliminated all kinds of useless information. And then that opened the door to understanding our universe even deeper than we ever had before. So it's made it infinitely more complex to us through a simple little equation, E equals MC squared.
Do you think through formulas and some of these concepts as you're creating for, let's say, Ask Smithsonian?
Sure.
What does that process look like? What would a story look like?
So for Ask Smithsonian, it's exceptionally collaborative. And although I'm sort of touted as the host, it's a very collaborative effort. And that's the way it should be in any creative endeavor. You should have a creative community, and you should ideally run in several. So my team, my production team, is my creative community. They all come from different backgrounds. And they themselves field questions from the public. We solicit them. We then take the questions we think would provide the most interesting answer to a large range of students primarily, and then we bounce around ideas on how to answer them. Usually a writer, our head writer, writes an actual answer, and then that goes to the group basically, and we sort of provide input. My job is to make sure the science is verifiable and defensible. But what's cool is we have a non-scientist write the scientific answers, or I should say this. We have someone whose domain of expertise has nothing to do with what I know as a molecular biologist, write the science answers. And actually, that goes counterintuitive to most things.
Well, I guess it makes sense. What's that? The famous, tell me like I'm five.
Yes.
You know, you have to really write down, because people aren't really paying attention. And if you want them to understand, then you have to, you know, just simplify so that they can understand quickly.
Yeah, you're right. Explain Like I'm Five is my favorite subreddit on Reddit. I'm addicted to Explain Like I'm Five. If you want to see great communication, you go to Explain Like I'm Five on Reddit, if anyone here is into that sort of thing.
Gotcha.
You're right. It's what is it? You ever heard of the webcomic XKCD?
No.
By Randall Monroe. He's a computer geek who writes one of the most popular webcomics, and it's technologically focused. He just published a book called What If? And he asks, like, what if you were able to throw a baseball at the speed of light? What would happen? Could you hit it? And what he describes is basically a nuclear bomb would go off and it would destroy half the earth. But he uses math in an explainable way. And he wrote this website called Upgoer 5. How would you explain the Saturn V rocket to a five-year-old? Using only words a five-year-old could understand. And it's called the Upgoer 5.
Wow. Cool. Okay. We talked a little bit about this offline, but in terms of your professional background, how did you get started in the science of creativity?
So like most people, completely on accident. How does anyone get in their career? I thought I was going to be a professional basketball player. I played college basketball and realized I hated basketball. Because when basketball became a business, I didn't want to do it anymore. I felt like cattle. So I decided I needed to have a real job. And I actually went to school to become an artist. And then I realized, oh, I don't know if I can make a career of that. I was the first person in my family to go to college. And my parents, as supportive of, as they were of my academics, really pushed athletics because it was my ticket out of the country bumpkin lifestyle that I was living in.
You say New Orleans?
Rural Texas.
Rural Texas. Okay.
And then I went to school in New Orleans and played 2 years of basketball, hated it, and then decided, science. I could be a teacher. I could like do research. I had a teacher that taught a class. She was like trying a new class and she was like, it's called molecular genetics. The syllabus was this. She handed me a piece of paper. She said, on this paper, in the fibers, is DNA from a bacteria that I've isolated. You need to get the DNA out, cut out a specific gene that I've placed in it, put that gene in a different piece of DNA, and then put that DNA in a different bacterium. Your final project will be handing me that functional bacterium that produces that gene's product, that protein. And I was like, you can do this? And my alcohol-addled undergraduate mind was blown that you could actually cut DNA with like molecular scissors. And the world opened up for me. Basically, I had my Carl Sagan moment at that point. And, you know, the cosmos opened up and the scientific god spoke to me. I don't know. And then after that, I went to school and I ran a lab and got my PhD, and I've just loved science ever since. And because of that, I've always wanted to know how people make cool stuff, including science. So that led me to creativity, as we mentioned earlier.
Was there a point where you specifically thought, you know what, I'm really actually going to study the science of creativity and how you integrated it into your work?
Yeah. So how I integrated my work was, as I mentioned earlier, with my organization Thirst, I really just wanted to know what makes truly eminently creative people creative. Is there a science to it? And I just took it on a hunch that maybe there was. And diving through literature, I discovered some very famous in their own right fields and authors and researchers, but no one knew about them. Through some of my work at Smithsonian, I worked with a woman who had worked with the Nobel Laureate Commission. And she had interviewed a lot of the Nobel laureates and told me, listen, these people, like, they're fascinating. You should study. There's a lot of work out there. And I'd start looking them up and looking into the research to see what it said. And did it match with my data from Thirst, from my drunken TED Talk-esque?
Yeah, I'm not sure that we paid proper homage to that because.
Well, let me get it from you. I'd love to hear your interpretation.
Oh, man. First of all, I've referred a number of people there, particularly single people, even though I know it's not exclusively single, but I think it's especially cool for single people because it's like it's nerdy, drunken TED Talks.
Yeah. Yeah. You're not right. You're not far off, actually.
Right. But it's really cool. I think they're all in D.C., or at least they all have been so far, right? Mm-hmm. And you go to a bar, and there's three or four or however many scientists who are also creatives and at least have the willingness to do the public speaking to be potentially heckled in a bar, giving an interesting talk like the science of online dating. And they talk for, 5-10 minutes, something like that. And it's a very interesting, typically smart and unique crowd that comes through.
Yeah, you pretty much nailed it. We wanted to challenge the idea of what communicating was. just like Nobel laureates, there's this like notion that, like, you've seen The Big Bang Theory?
Sure.
Okay. Then the main character, Sheldon, who sort of billed as this, in sort of a pejorative way, this sort of like on the autistic spectrum of disorders. He's never outright said the character's based on that, but he's taken influence, as he said, the actor that plays him.
Sure.
And I have to be careful. One of my friends is a writer on the show, so it's okay, Chad. Don't be afraid. I'm going to talk a little bit about your show. But the point is, they bill the most brilliant people in the show are the least communicative, the least socially apt to have a good social experience. Like Penny, the sort of normal person that lives next door, is sort of seen as an outsider for being not smart and having social skills. This could not be farther from reality in terms of studying science and like where thirst came from. Nobel laureates, the master idea creators on this planet, are master communicators. They understand the power of their ideas and the breadth of their ideas. Einstein knew that his idea had more than an effect in physics. It would have an impact in mathematics. It would have an impact in daily lives. And I'm sure in marketing, too. The point is, they understood how to brand and market an idea. So truly creative people understand marketing, whether they're a scientist or artist.
Love it.
That's one of the most like revelatory parts I've heard recently in some of the research that came out, that like if you want to be the best, you have to be the best at communicating it.
Very cool. Well, the next question that I have relates to passions. What keeps you passionate about your work? And parallel to that, how do you keep that passion produced into your work? How does that passion keep the work that you're producing going?
I want to know everything. I want to know why. I want to know why I can't know something. I want to know all the things. I can't know enough. I literally think this is the only ride I'm going to get on this celestial orb, making some elliptical orbit through an electron cloud, you know, in this particular part of this tiny little galaxy that's fairly nondescript in this nondescript part of the universe. You know, this little ape that learned its way, you know, down from the trees and onto the ground, but we still looked up. And I still think that, like, I want to know why. And that honestly keeps me going. Your mind is something you have to exercise just like anything else. And learning is exercising your mind. I just love learning. I love learning from people. I don't know anything about marketing, probably, compared to you, but I love the idea that I can. That's what keeps me going. Being able to understand something, and then, like, by the time I die, I'll say to myself, I know so much, I know so little. And now someone else can have that burden.
Very nice. Now, what did they say, that wisdom is when you finally understand that you know very little?
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah. There's an effect for the opposite of that. It's called the Dunning-Kruger effect. It was recently discovered. It's the exact opposite. It's the less you objectively know about a subject, the more you will claim confidence in how well you know that subject.
That's really funny.
And it's an actual thing we have to account for in expertise and running studies, for example. People overcompensate for what they think they know. It's actually an indicator of how little you know is how much you claim to know about something.
Wow. That's funny. Well, how do you integrate the science of creativity into your work on a regular basis?
To me, the most important way to integrate the sort of science of creativity is to, one, ask the opinions of other people. You as an individual are not creative. Your community is creative. Creativity doesn't exist for an individual. The research is very clear about this. The idea of the toiling genius, what's the name of the movie with Leonardo DiCaprio where he plays the eccentric billionaire that locks himself away?
Is it The Great Gatsby or no?
I was older than that. He plays this eccentric billionaire that locks himself away. A real life. Well, no. Anyway, the point is, the idea of this like toiling genius sitting in their basement, like creating the next cancer cure, is BS. There is no evidence that supports that. All evidence points to, if you want to create the next cancer cure, you're going to have to work with lots of people. And that's because there's no such thing as an individual that's a creative. It's a creative community. And it's because it's a give-take relationship. You have to produce work quantity that has to be evaluated by others. That's the quality part. So quality is determined by others. That's not your job as a producer of creative stuff. That's a huge issue a lot of people never get over. They never learn to accept constructive criticism or criticism in general, even if it's undue for their work.
Interesting. Yeah, you know, we talk a lot about the lean startup method on the show somehow. And it just comes up. I guess it's hot in the field at the moment. And something I heard recently was somebody went out and they studied a bunch of billionaires. And they tried to determine what patterns were surfacing amongst the billionaires. And what they found was they were not shooting for perfection. They were shooting for rapid experimentation. And so it's interesting to hear you say that the real creative genius is in the group think and getting it out there, getting the quantity, and in the quantity, there will be quality. Quality ends up rising up. And maybe I'm paraphrasing too much.
No, you're absolutely. It's, I would add to it. Mm-hmm. And it's the creativity is not necessarily in the group think itself. It's in sharing that with a group, but ultimately doing what you feel creatively. So taking their advice and still doing what you believe is you. Mm-hmm. Truly creative people view creating as play. I don't invoke a lot of neuroscience in the work because it's too new of a field still. But like, for example, there's no left brain, right brain. No one's a right brain person. That's BS too. That it's not supported by any evidence whatsoever. In fact, if you were just operating in your right hemisphere, you'd probably have a medical condition that requires a doctor. That's not a good thing to be happening. And if all of your brain was working all at once, like that whole 10%, did you see Lucy with
Morgan? I did. Yeah, that was embarrassing, so even for a non-scientist.
This creativity thing, like unlocking your mind's potential and using 100% of your brain. If you used 100% of your brain, you'd have, it's called a grand mal seizure, and you'd be dead. Use most of your brain most of the time. It's just where you decide to like focus your energy, if that makes any sense. But yeah, getting back to your point about lean startups, and that's totally true. Like doing cool stuff requires you to iterate quickly. I'm not as familiar with lean startups as you are.
Well,
probably.
That really is the crux of it is you try to get a product out as quickly as possible, as lean as possible. And then you test and then you iterate and the process keeps going.
Hmm.
And it's right in line with what I was describing about the spiral marketing. It's iterative growth.
Right. Right. Interesting. Today I learned I need the NBC, The More You Know, star to fly over my head.
I bet we can get the sound guy to find that somewhere. So how about influencers and inspiration for this field specifically? Is there any king of scientists for creativity?
Oh, there's an undisputed king in this field.
Yeah.
His name is Dean Keith Simonton. He's a researcher at University of California in Davis. And this guy works in relative obscurity, but is the jug. He wrote the only textbook on creativity.
Wow.
And to give you an idea of how new of a field this is, even though it's been happening for hundreds of years, this textbook didn't come out till this year.
Wow.
This has been something think of it this way. Like, so 50 years ago, if I told you you could study scientifically creativity, mm-hmm. you would have been laughed out of the building as a scientist. Now that question, if you came forward, now it's accepted that we can study it through fMRIs, you know, neuroscience, although I take a little bit of issue with the neuroscientific-ish aspect. Mm-hmm. Now the question is, how do we measure curation? Can you scientifically predict someone who's going to be good at choosing the next idea? That's the new frontier of creativity research.
Interesting.
How do you foster, what are the Nobel laureate-like characteristics of a curator? And that's going to be, because ideas are a dime a dozen. It's the person who knows which idea is going to hit is the person that's valuable in a community.
Well, then you might look at the investors.
Hmm.
Because the investors who have the highest success rate arguably are the best at curation.
Right. And if you were to run a study on it, I would actually like try to figure out what characteristics give them their edge. What expertise do they have that other people don't? And I mean, I don't know, frankly, but another influence is Arthur I. Miller, who writes about the intersection of science and art and how he believes art and science are melding into one field that he calls sci art. But that is more art than science. He believes it. And here's the thing. It sounds crazy now, but there's a premise for this. Science cannot exist. It literally cannot exist. It was not discovered until art became accepted as a part of cultures around the world. Art has to exist first for science to exist, no matter what we look at.
Every culture
that invented art or treated artists as citizens or as a part of their communities, science prospered eventually. But science never came first, ever. We've never invented science before art.
Why do you think that is?
There's a couple of reasons, but no one really knows for sure. The number one is that if you can afford as a society to have and harbor great artists, you have a somewhat, you have a prosperous society. Art, at even in early humanity, was seen as sort of a leisurely activity that wasn't necessary. The moment it becomes something that's part of the culture, it means society's stable enough to harbor the scientific endeavor. Also, you have to invent public sanitation. So remember that whole quantity argument I was saying, you need to have people that need to be born that possibly could invent stuff. And if you're struggling to crack 2 billion people, which we didn't as a world or globe until the mid-19th century, you didn't have enough people to create stuff, like just playing the probability game. So you have to like understand that people are going to, you know, public sanitation, germ theory of disease, all this stuff. You had to have enough people.
I see. I've got this saying. I don't know where I picked it up from. It's art from ink spills.
True.
Because a lot of times art, it almost comes off as like an accident. Two people riffing, they come up with an idea, ends up being art.
Sure. You absolutely.
Know? Whether it's a song or it could be any number of things. Arguably, when somebody comes up with something brand new, they're just experimenting in their minds.
Oh, yes. That whole process is called ideation. And it's there's several steps to creating an idea. And that's one of them. I think there's five of them, and at least in the literature. And the first one is ideation. You have to bumble around these ideas in your head, toss them around, and then five to six or seven of them, whatever, end up getting like to the front of your brain, the prefrontal cortex, the supercomputer, if it will, you know, gets time on the supercomputer so it can do some processing. But all this presupposes that you are exposed to enough stuff to create the ideas.
Do you know the other five steps?
Off the top of my head. Oh, my goodness.
Putting you on the spot here.
Right. I don't have my other notebook with me. But it's the general flow of the ideas is you have to collect information, and that's exposure. Then you have to ideate. You have to create the ideas. Then you have to allow them to go through what's called Darwinian selection. There's an evolutionary process in your brain that has to happen with the ideas itself, right? And this happens sort of you're semi-aware of it. Fourth step is walking away, is allowing those ideas to just sort of ferment in your head. That actually, and we now know what part of your brain is taking care of them at that point. Walking away is called the default mode network. It's the part of your brain that becomes active when you're not thinking about anything. We thought it's like when you're in the shower, when you're driving, on your way to work.
Similar to a subconsciousness of sorts.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But it's autopilot for your brain. And we thought, oh, it's just doing autopilot. It's just taking over. Turns out that's not true. It's your brain's housekeeper. During the day, you're receiving information and your brain is just shoving it places. So you, then your default mode network, takes it, picks up that piece of information and places it in its proper brain space on the shelf. And that's when an idea clicks.
Very cool.
And then the last step is actually like producing the idea, like doing it.
Okay. Well, it's a perfect segue, I think, because I was going to ask you, how do you think the science of creativity can help somebody who's trying to come up with a creative idea, like a marketing campaign, a new brand, something like that?
This is going to sound really weird because it goes against what a lot of people think, but the evidence points towards the contrary. You have to tell as many people as possible. You have to bounce that idea. Anyway, and that's weird because you're like, oh, it's my idea. I want to protect it. No, you have to tell as many people as you possibly can the idea. Forcing yourself to flesh it out, forcing yourself to get feedback, not because you want them to tell you yes or no, but one, it has two effects. It builds a creative community around the idea already. And two, it allows your brain to work out any kinks as you're explaining it. So that's like the big way that like people don't realize. And that has a huge effect on future ideas that you might develop. We know that if you pitch an idea, it's what I call the sort of Paris Hilton, Kim Kardashian hypothesis. They have no discernible value in society. None. But they're super famous, worth billions of dollars or millions of dollars, whatever, for nothing discernibly good, right? Why? Because people at some point thought they were worth pitching an idea to. And then those people heard that they pitched an idea. So the circle grew wider and more people pitched ideas. And so these Kim Kardashian, Paris Hilton types, they are now exposed to tons of creative ideas every day. And just by virtue of being around all of those wonderful ideas, because they initially were told that was okay, they now get to be super creative because they're around a ton of creative ideas. And we know this works, unfortunately.
Wow, that's so interesting. So it's almost like the popular girl syndrome times, you know, 1,000.
It goes to the quantity argument again. If you pitch your idea to everyone, they start thinking you're the person that has the ideas. They'll pitch you theirs. As more people find that out, you will be pitched to over and over and over again. This is why Steve Jobs, impartially, I know he's invoked a lot, part of what is attributed to his success, other than being crazy, was that a lot of different people pitched him ideas and he was aware of them. We know no matter whatever you take the size of a creative community, say you have 100 people that are close to you that you would pitch this idea to. We know that the square root of the size of that community is the number of people that will produce over half of the ideas in that community. So in a community of 100, 10 people will produce half of the ideas that get developed. So if you have, you know, as you get, you can imagine in a group of 4 people, 2 people are producing half the ideas. But as it gets bigger and bigger, less and less people are producing all of the ideas.
Interesting. It's not far from the 80-20 rule.
Sure. Well, so what's really interesting, too, is, for example, like I could fire right now like the lower 50%, the least productive scientists in the world if we organize them by productivity. Mm-hmm. And the world's productivity would fall by only a seventh in scientific output. Like you just got rid of half of the workforce.
Wow.
And still almost everyone else. And this is true for any field. We know this is true. It's called power law. It's been known for a long time and you can model it. It's called, there's a little wonderful thing called a Lotka curve. And this is true for any field
wonderful.
Across yeah. all fields, even like Aristotle compared to Einstein, like you can compare them in terms of output. And Aristotle puts Einstein to shame in terms of how much more work he produced. Like he ran a school, like everyone talked to him. So
right.
my point
oh, yeah,
is
Aristotle. He's, you know, like I feel like we wouldn't be speaking, you know, like there wouldn't be microphones or anything. He's at the root of so much of modern civilization. So
that's true. We also wouldn't have zero. Well, he didn't invent it. But my point is, for all the things that the Greeks are given credit for, Pythagorean theorem, wine or whatever, they didn't invent two things, soap and zero. Seriously, not all technological innovations are practical. And it goes to show you that they could figure this out. They figure out how to run water from the mountains to the city center, but they couldn't invent soap and the concept of zero, which literally did revolutionize the modern world.
Seems like we touched a nerve there on soap and zero.
See, it's the little things that get the scientists all up in arms.
Okay. Well, is there any resource for insight and inspiration that you'd recommend for folks who want to learn more here? Yeah, you mentioned The Godfather, but if you wanted to say, all right, team, we need to get creative here, what would be a potential resource to look at?
So anything written by Scott Barry Kaufman at Huffington Post, believe it or not, he's a researcher who is probably the best at like keeping up with communicating how this research is progressing. But in terms of, like looking online or just like
sure.
what could people do? Like
either one, actually. Yeah, they're both because tips and tricks, resources, those are both really helpful.
Easiest tips. It's going to sound silly, but practicing your analogies. The more we know that it's a high predictor of creativity is your ability to form analogies. That's why it's tested on the SAT. I know it seems silly, but it's actually really true. Building analogies allows you to open up your mind to different ideas, especially distant analogies. Running in 5 to 6 different creative communities that are all less than 100 people in size. And that actually takes some time to think about. You should run between multiple different crowds. That actually will almost guarantee that you're producing ideas. Tell your ideas to people regularly, often, and get feedback, but you don't have to listen to it.
Mm-hmm.
That's another thing. Produce, 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 produce. You have to actually produce ideas. And we know the more you produce, the more likely one's going to hit. And that's according to what the evidence says. So, and probably the one thing most people don't think about is you have to live in a city that has a certain population density. This has a huge impact on your creativity, with online is sort of helping disappear, make this disappear. DC just makes it, actually.
Just makes it.
Just makes it. Most of Nova doesn't. That's about 4,000 people per kilometer squared. Above that, and your chances of producing an idea that hit for some reason go up exponentially. So, I don't know. It's really interesting. Yeah, it's weird. It's weird things that sort of tether together.
Farmers are screwed, huh?
Yeah, but their chickens and pigs are great. I'm going to come up with the next one.
So creative. Okay. How about a question to challenge yourself to perform better?
Who could I talk to or ask that will completely destroy my idea's fundamental premise?
Awesome. What's the next big project for you?
I'll be launching another television show here soon, hopefully, but also more importantly, as a personal project, I'm going to be launching a scientific talent agency that evaluates scientists, not on their scientific credentials exclusively, but their communication ability in different venues. So evaluating them that way so that we can get at their next generation of science communicators out there and promoted properly.
On top of the other four projects that you've got going?
Yeah, I don't sleep. Bill Nye the Science Guy and Neil deGrasse Tyson can't have all the fun.
Okay. What do you think the future of this topic will look like? It's one of my favorite questions.
That is a great question. I hope we're sitting here 5 years from now or whatever, discussing how people now are able to predict taste. Taste is a scientific measure. Like, it's not just like you can produce ideas. It's your taste is predictable and scientifically testable. That's incredible.
Oh, taste is in style.
Right. That you're not only that, but I can predict what your taste will be, that you have, and your taste is not only quantifiable, but it's what is needed, like for a field. Like, we know that whatever comes out of your mouth is what the field will become, but from a scientific perspective.
Wow.
That, I hope that happens. That's like Minority Report sort of stuff, but in a good way. I want the Tom Cruise gloves.
Perfect. Thank you. Okay. What's the best place for people to learn more and to reach you?
The easiest is Twitter. It's @ScienceEric with one E. Or you can send me an email. I'm happy to give that to you, or on my About Me page. But Twitter's easiest, @ScienceEric.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Perfect.
If you have a question out there in the land of electrons, I love to try and answer it.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
Thank you, sir.
Now, maybe it was the inspirational topic, or maybe it was the ginger mind meld. But dropping all formality here, I'm going to ask you, as you live your life, building relationships, careers, and your legacy like a pyramid in the sands of time, using all matters of electronic technology, smartphones, laptops, the internet, what if we learned that electronics are sentient beings with feelings? Would they be angry about how we've used them? Would they seek emotional validation? Or maybe as we've entered into the digital age, they've been learning from us all along. This isn't just nonsense like the plot of a silly children's cartoon. It's also an exercise in Eric's teachings to challenge our thinking with unique perspectives, crowdsource more ideas, and produce a lot more to have your creative work stand out like that of a Nobel laureate. Thanks for listening and playing along, folks. Cheers.